Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with author and journalist Scott Wallace. His latest book is The Unconquered, and you can read his articles in National Geographic magazine. You can find his website at scottwallace.com. Are there nonprofit groups trying to help protect the rights of these Aboriginal people?
There are. Survival International is one that comes to mind. The Amazon Conservation Team, which is based outside of Washington, D.C. in Virginia, is another one. Amazon Watch. There are several groups working to defend the rights of indigenous people and the uncontacted tribes in the Amazon, either by pressuring the governments to demarcate lands, to stop oil exploration in the lands where uncontacted groups are known to exist, or to stop loggers from logging in those lands, or to actually help indigenous tribes who inhabit the borderlands around these places where the uncontacted tribes hold forth, to actually organize them in vigilance committees to protect the boundaries of these protected areas, these national parks and protected areas.
Well, as we wrap up, I should point out for listeners that you, Scott Wallace, have followed dangerous and fascinating stories all over the world. There's a good biopic about you on your website, scottwallace.com, and on YouTube. You have been listening to Scott Wallace, author of The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. He's a frequent contributor to National Geographic magazine, writing about vanishing cultures and the environment. Find more links in my show blog at ecoshock.info and get the latest from scottwallace.com. Scott, thank you so much for sharing your adventures with us.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure being here today.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can take that Scott Wallace interview as the first installment in my series on human extinction. Next week, we'll investigate the growing chorus saying the human species will go extinct before the middle of this century. I'll tell you who's behind it, what the real science says. It's a tale with a twist. Tune in next week for sure.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Meanwhile, I have to update you on stories you heard first on Radio EcoShock. In our program on the 1st of May 2013, you heard Nicole Rycroft of the green group Canopy explain why they pulled out of the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement. It was a key effort to preserve at least half of the necklace of slow-growing trees across the top of Canada, now being clear-cut and logged by dozens of forest companies. Rycroft told us after 3 years of direct negotiations with major logging companies, promises were not kept, deadlines were not met, and not a single hectare of boreal forest was legally protected. Canopy is going back to the 700 companies who promised to avoid old-growth timber from Canada's boreal forest. Now the largest company involved in the boreal, Resolute Forest Products, and they were formerly known as Abitibi Bowwater, they have pulled out of the talks. Resolute says the environmentalists are asking too much. The company would have to close mills, and the impoverished northern Aboriginal communities would suffer if Resolute doesn't continue massive logging operations in the north of two Canadian provinces, Ontario and Quebec. Some Canadian newspapers reported the agreement had collapsed, now that Greenpeace, Canopy, and Resolute Pulp and Paper were out. Other large timber companies have not announced they are leaving the talks, although they may if they feel they will be at a competitive disadvantage. Three large environment and conservation groups say they will continue to push for protection of the boreal forest through this agreement. One major funder, the Ivy Foundation, put at least $5 million into this effort. Here is a statement by Todd, Executive Director of Forest Ethics, followed by Tim Gray, Program Director of the Ivy Foundation. I recorded this from a media conference on May 21st.
Hi, folks. This is Todd Paglia. I'm the Executive Director of Forest Ethics, and I wanted to offer you some of our reflections on this unfortunate endpoint with Resolute. First of all, I want to emphasize that I think I can speak on behalf of all the NGOs that are part of the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement in saying that we feel that the CBFA has a model that works, that it can succeed, and that in some cases it is beginning to succeed, and that we are still committed to the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, even while at the same time we are at an end point with Resolute. So I want to make that part clear. We have seen over the years a lot of extremely hard work, literally tens of thousands of hours in the CBFA, working towards win-win solutions that are extremely difficult to arrive at. Getting environmentalists and logging companies to come to an agreement is not easy. And what we're seeing with companies that we're working with in the CBFA, like Tolko, Weyerhaeuser, Corner Brook, Pulp and Paper, Tembec, Alpac, Miller Western, is that there's a real sense of rolling up our sleeves, diving in and trying to do the hard work of coming to an agreement where every side gives. And that is exactly the opposite situation we have been in for the last 3 years with Resolute. And with Resolute, their stance has been pretty much all take and no give. And when we look at the CBFA going forward, we feel like Resolute is the bad apple, and that the rest of the bushel is in very good shape and will make progress that we're all going to be proud of. I think Janet has already summarized a bit of a sense of where we ended up with Resolute doing basically what in Quebec the law requires. In other words, the CBFA would then stand for we are not illegal. That's not exactly the vision that we had for the CBFA, and it's not acceptable that Resolute has adopted that position. In Ontario, as mentioned, they have expanded operations since the signing of the CBFA, and in the midst of our negotiations last week, in the closing hours of trying to come to a win-win, they announced during their annual general meeting an expansion and that they're going to be acquiring more companies. In other words, fragmenting these already fragile forests even more. All of these things are anathema to the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement and the goal that we all had in signing on to this incredibly ambitious endeavor. And for forest ethics, what it means in the marketplace is that Resolute will be increasingly a source of conflict paper, pulp, and lumber products. That as opposed to coming to agreement with NGOs to do the hard thing of coming to a compromise, they're pursuing their narrow economic interests, and that means more and more conflict for them moving forward. And so when we speak to the North American and European and beyond marketplaces, what we'll be saying is that if you're looking for a product that will put your brand at risk, look no further than Resolute. Now, I'll conclude there, and I think we're handing it off next to Tim Gray from the Ivy Foundation.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, this is Tim Graham, Program Director with the Ivy Foundation. The Ivy Foundation is a private charitable foundation based in Toronto, and we support solving complex environmental and economic problems through collaboration. For that reason, we've provided over $5 million in funding to the implementation of the CBFA over the last several years because we believed it was a framework for conserving forests in a way that would enhance economic prosperity. We've had a history of funding collaborative exercises between environmental organizations and industry, including in Ontario under the Ontario Forest Accord and in Nova Scotia with the Colin Stewart Forest Forum. Both of these resulted in significant increases in the amount of protected lands with full collaboration and buy-in of major forest companies. Unfortunately, in the current situation, Resolute Forest products have been unable or unwilling to agree to conservation measures that would meet minimum standards required to achieve a reasonable chance of survival for woodland caribou within their licenses in northwestern Ontario and Quebec. They've also failed to agree to recommendations that would complete a network of protected areas that would ensure other plants and animals in their harvest areas have adequate parts of their ranges protected as a guarantee of future survival. We're very disappointed that no progress has been made with Resolute. But of course, we will continue to support the implementation of CBFA in other areas. In my view, the failure to achieve an outcome here is a result of poor leadership at the senior management levels. We had very constructive, collaborative discussions with folks on the ground within the company, but the leadership of this company did not want this agreement to work, and that we're very disappointed.
You just heard Tim Gray from the Ivy Foundation, preceded by Todd Paglia of Forest Ethics. Both groups still support the Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement process, despite the loss of other major environment and company participants. I don't know if the process can continue, or if they can protect enough of the boreal to save the endangered woodland caribou. The real issue, from my perspective, is not just the value of this intact ecosphere of the North, as important as that is, but the big impact rampant logging will have on climate change. The boreal forest could turn from being a carbon sink, moderating what is left of our climate, to a carbon source. This huge northern forest could take hundreds of years to grow back, if it ever does. Meanwhile, we witness another positive feedback loop heating the globe and created by the human impulse to grab natural resources at any cost, at any risk. Environment groups like Greenpeace and Canopy will push Resolute Forest products to meet the needs of nature. You can help by disinvesting in this rogue company and making sure your pension plans and corporations are not supporting their paper products. On to another story brought to light by Radio EcoShock. Over the years, I've investigated the claims and activities of one Russ George. On September 7th and 14th, 2007, I did a two-part interview and critique of George's attempt to modify the climate by stimulating plankton blooms with iron. That effort failed. The multi-million dollar stock promotion of his company, Planktos, went bankrupt. In the middle of October 2012, I did interviews and clips from a Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation press conference at the Vancouver Aquarium. Leaders from the Haida village of Old Masset attempted to explain to the world press how and why they secretly performed a geoengineering experiment, possibly the world's biggest, in the Pacific Ocean near their home on the island of Haida Gwaii. The village spent $2.5 million on Russ George's dream to create carbon credits for sale and allegedly replenish the failing salmon stock. No carbon credits were sold, and it appears the villagers will lose their money in this scheme. On April 10th, I announced the offices of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation were raided by armed officers of the federal agency Environment Canada. All computers and files were taken away. Despite this, Russ George told the Times Columnist newspaper in British Columbia that he and the First Nations people would run a second experiment on the wild algae in the summer of 2013. He's gonna do it again, he said. On April 30th, I attended an online briefing by the American National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, on marine geoengineering and possible legal barriers against unilateral experimenters like Russ George. The audio quality is poor, but you can make out these two quick clips. First, Richard Mannix, a legal expert from NOAA's Office of the General Counsel, notes the Russ George Haida Village experiment may have damaged clam beds on the island of Haida Gwaii. Second, lawyer Richard Mannix points out there is no central legal authority to regulate or stop geoengineering experiments. Dumping iron into the sea should be controlled by the London Dumping Convention and the London Protocol, but there is nothing saying who might spray sulfates into the atmosphere or launch mirrors into space to reduce sunlight arriving on our jointly owned planet. Without such an agency, Mannix feels we are encouraging a wild west of geoengineering. Let's listen in.
Well, fortunately, ocean fertilization seems to have a home, but there isn't a home yet for other techniques. It's not going to be one home. If we're talking about putting mirrors in space, that's not something that the London Convention can take care of. That's another treaty. But we need some kind of coordinated approach to these things so that it doesn't become the Wild West. We need some kind of common set of principles. We need some forum for dialogue. We need to bring this together in some organized way. If the international community is going to continue to adopt ad hoc bans on specific activity, that will discourage legitimate research that we need to give us direction. It will also tend to make the research something private, something hidden, something not open to the public or available generally to science. And it will also perpetuate an atmosphere in which the rogue nation or entity are going to feel free to go off and do what they want. And time's a wasting, but hopefully we can bring this into some organized control relatively soon.
I managed to get in a question at the end of that teleconference, saying Russ George promises to repeat his ocean dumping scheme this year, and what could stop him? Well, the attendees did not know that Russ was planning to do it again, but Mannix replied he was confident in the Canadian authorities that they were investigating thoroughly, and it was possible, he said, Russ George could end up in the slammer. His words, the slammer, of course, is slang for jail. We will see. The story continues. On May 23rd, the Haida villagers announced on Canadian Newswire they were severing all ties with Russ George. The HSRC said, quote, it has removed Mr. Russ George as a director of the company. In addition, the HSRC has terminated Mr. George's employment as an officer of the corporation. Old Masset Village Chief Counselor Ken Ray stated, the board and our community has decided to recalibrate this business so that it moves forward in a constructive fashion and effectively responds to legitimate concerns raised by various stakeholders around the world, end quote. It sounds like Russ George is out of a job, but not so fast. Russ George told the Vancouver Sun he can't be fired. Russ George said the board of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation did not have the authority to remove him. We learned from Russ that he owns 48% of HSRC through his own company called Ocean Pastures Corp. He's just a genius at setting up various companies with all sorts of names, as we've found out. George promised to keep on going with this project. Now, that's moxie. His data and equipment were seized by the Canadian government, with likely legal action pending. The Haida villagers, a potent group, to say the least, insist they have severed all ties with Russ George. Village Chief Ken Ray told the Times columnist, "We have parted ways." I would read that more or less as a ban from the island, especially since the senior governing body of the Haida already denounced the experiment. Ken Ray says no plankton seeding experiment will be done this year. Well, that should end the story. But Russ George never really goes away. He's back on his blog touting his other persona, the amateur physics experimenter with a world-saving technology in cold fusion. His company, D2 Fusion, went bankrupt years ago. On his blog, George says he's worked on cold fusion since its discovery in 1989. His work was making a documentary film about it. With the failure of this plankton scheme, again, Russ George could next reappear as a businessman advocate for cold fusion. It's never over for Russ George with his big dreams and multi-million dollar losing schemes.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
Moving on, I have one more recording for you. On May 16th, Eric Hoffner of Orion Magazine hosted a web chat called City Mouse, City Flower, a discussion of urban nature. Guests were Beatrix Beisner, co-editor of the new urban ecology guidebook, Nature All Around Us, and Liam Hennigan of DePaul University Chicago Wilderness Science Team, along with Kevin Anderson, the proprietor of the blog Marginal Nature. I was intrigued with the struggles and ideas in the discussion between Liam Hennigan, working from an academic planning perspective, and Kevin Anderson, who by day is a water and sewage worker for the city of Austin in Texas. Anderson definitely gets his hands dirty and laments the trend of cutting down foreign species to create the imagined past landscape, and during one of the worst droughts in living memory in Texas. Let's tune in as Eric of Orion Magazine brings up adaptation to urban conditions. Kevin Anderson weighs in with a hot debate. Should humans try to engineer nature again, this time right in the cities where we live? From Orion Magazine.
Yeah, this is Kevin. So one of the things I pointed out, right, it often gets focused on plants, the non-native plants, so buckthorn up in Chicago. And
yep.
Here we have our list, the Chinese species must be eliminated, even though they've been here since the 1850s. And one of the things that often happens, though, with those non-native species is they aren't studied for wildlife benefits. There's a presumption that they are less useful than the natives that were here. And when you begin to study them for what's utilizing them, many of these are we're finding have become host plants for insects or our nectar sources, or, mm-hmm. you know, and the list goes on. We're at a time where that's being battled out, mm-hmm. right, in culture and in that cultural practice and then into management. Within the science of ecology, you know, that idea of a native species within ecology proper is of limited usefulness because it's temporally bound. This is very much a cultural question of what do we value, what are the most important, with, again, the exceptions that there are problem species. You know, mm-hmm. with plants, we've always called them weeds, and there's always been weeds. I will mention a book, Richard Mabee, the great British nature writer, his latest book, the title is Weeds. Again, when we shift into a European setting or a British setting, there is a different history, a different arc to this conversation about cities and native species and non-natives.
Yeah, I'm largely sympathetic to what you're saying, Kevin, but I mean, I note that you say, and it's an important qualification, that I mean, there's a lot of species that we're never going to worry about. I mean, other than on lawns, people are not going to be worried about daisies and dandelions. But, you know, when our objective, agreed through consensus, hopefully, that there are certain areas that are being set aside for their conservation value, then very often our biggest obstacle is a dominant invasive species. Mm-hmm. So
true.
Managers are not going to get, like, overly exercised about some things that are just hanging out in the system doing very little damage. But it is worth, and you know, underscoring that there are certain species that create these conflicts for us.
But notice the context you mentioned, right, in a park or a preserve, and these are special landscapes managed for very particular...
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the earthworm thing as well, as you probably know, there's no native earthworms, terrestrial earthworms in this part of Illinois. So we're in the kind of curious position where, you know, I don't think anyone would be objecting to earthworms in the garden. In fact, that's a kind of a good thing. You know, we have then this curious problem of having non-native earthworms in areas set aside for conservation. And without a doubt, they're changing the dynamics of these systems in ways that have us completely scratching our head. Like, it's
right.
very difficult to manage for these things.
Yeah, and right, post-glaciation, those native species changed everything too,
mm-hmm.
right? So from the longer perspective of ecology proper, these are changes that unfold over time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what we decide to do within a refuge or a preserve is a special case. The other 90% or 95% of the urban ecosystem is another case. What I see in Austin, we try to take the same set of values and apply it for the whole system, and ultimately are disappointed because the system doesn't behave the way we
yeah.
want it to.
So here's a kind of maybe the elephant in the room question. Several people have brought it up in the text chat here. It's got to do with the biggest question of the day, climate change. How would you suggest cities might best prepare, Mike wants to know, prepare their urban ecosystems for a rapidly changing climate? How are we going to adapt to that, and how important is our urban ecology going to be?
Yeah, I mean, in Chicago Wilderness, climate change is a central topic for us. We've got a climate change task force, and the city itself, I think, you know, over a couple of administrations has been out front on that being an issue. The thing is, what we know, right, about the urban environment is that the structures that we created have changed the heat budget of islands in a way that's not necessarily kind of conducive to our best interests. So we have a lot of management options for managing the urban environment, changing kind of the albedo, the kind of reflectance of surfaces, very often using kind of the management of nature. So in Chicago, for instance, we're blessed with a really vigorous urban forest, and that's kind of a big part of the plan, not only in terms of sequestering carbon, but in just, like, you know, providing shade relief and in changing kind of the dynamics, the kind of radiation dynamics of the city.
I work for a water utility for a city, and things are quite bleak. We don't have a good track record in rapid response to change. And right now we're in a prolonged, very serious drought here in Central Texas, in Texas, and we're improvising. We went through a similar drought in the 1950s, So we had plenty of time to plan, and nothing really substantial was done. And so the greater change of climate that will surely unfold, the general things that we know we can do, and some of that was what Liam was mentioning, are there for us to do. And to use that example, Liam, right, that urban forest movement for climate is a different set of parameters than urban forest for greenery. I see this here in Austin now. We're still in the greenery stuff. It's great. There's a lot of motivation for urban forest here. But again, it's built around the native versus non-native species. And so they're cutting down all of these thriving non-native trees that are on the hit list during a catastrophic drought. And folks on the climate side, and I would be one of those, would say, don't cut down anything living during this drought. They're the ones we should study because the system's changing. That's one aspect to the broader ecosystem parameters that are impacted by climate change. For another thing that we've recognized with water in the Southwest, right, is our power plants on waterways depend on a water temperature that can cool them. And during this extreme heat, the 2011 summer, where we had 90 days over 100 degrees, the water temperature got near to a point where they could no longer use it to cool their plants. And so these recognitions, too, coming with management of the city in a brand new situation, it's very daunting. And yet, as Liam said, there's some very basic things that we can do and we need to be doing, as well as looking forward and thinking about what will the new system be, because it's coming. Get Bill Cronin's book, Uncommon Ground, Rethinking the Human Place in Nature. It's 1995, and that's pushed a lot of the ideas that we're talking about. And again, Bill's point was we need to embrace the full continuum of a natural landscape, and that natural landscapes are also cultural landscapes. And I want to end with a shout-out to Orion, because much of my work on marginal nature traces back to an Orion writers group that was at the SER conference here in Austin in 1998, I think. Folks need to keep their subscriptions up.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for the endorsement. And actually, Kevin sent me a long list, a bibliography of books to read. If anyone wants to see the entire thing, email events@orionmagazine.org, and I'll send that to you so you have all your reading lined up for the next year. These conversations are made possible by subscriptions to Orion and by your donation, so please go to orionmagazine.org/donate to support our efforts to bring people together for conversations like this.
Find the full 80-minute discussion, City Mouse, City Flower, A Discussion of Urban Nature, as an audio file at orionmagazine.org, or use the link from my show blog at ecoshock.info. Next week, we'll ask the question, are we humans doomed to an early extinction? I hope the answer is no. You'll hear the arguments as Radio EcoShock continues to cover the biggest pictures. I'm Alex Smith. You can support my work at the show website, ecoshock.org. Catch up on any programs you've missed as free MP3 downloads at that site. Please tell your friends about Radio EcoShock, and thank you for listening.